Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, good afternoon. Are you prepared to proceed? Okay, then we will call our third case of the day, Barney versus Mickelson.
Good afternoon, Justices. I'm James Gutglass, and I represent the petitioners Julie Mickelson, M.D., and Columbia St. Mary's Hospital of Milwaukee. Thank you for the opportunity for us to appear before you today to present oral argument. We're here to address the District 1 appellate court decision in Barney and explain why we are asking the court to overturn it and reinstate the jury verdict that exonerated Dr. Mickelson after a three-week trial. In doing so, we see that this case is really focused on one major issue, which is, was the alternative methods of treatment paragraph in Wisconsin Jury Instruction 1023 appropriate to give to the jury? As you know from what we filed, we feel the answer to that is a resounding yes, and our position is that it was and is an accurate statement of the law in Wisconsin, and that given the testimony that the jury heard at trial, it would have been error not to give that instruction.
Counsel?
Yes.
First of all, let me say I'm having some back problems, so I may stand occasionally during argument. It seems to me that a lot of cases and a lot of life depends on how you focus the lens. And there seems to be little doubt that there is an alternative method in this case. The question for me as I narrow that lens is there an alternative method during that 90-minute period of pushing where the Court of Appeals thought not so? The Court of Appeals thought that it was the external monitoring was not as reliable as other methods. Can you address that 90-minute period, please?
Sure. During that period of time, Mrs. Barney was being monitored with the external monitor, and there were some periods, fairly brief, where there was sketchiness or dropout. There was one, I think, eight-minute period.
8 minutes.
That was
correct.
Referred to.
Yes.
Where the dropout was related to maternal repositioning of the mother on the bed by the staff. And so we learned from the expert testimony that a period of time needs to go by before you can really make decisions about whether the monitor strip is concerning or not. If you feel that it's not adequately picking it up, there are other things that you can use, but she had the strip, she had the audio of the baby's heart rate, which can be distinguished from the mother's. She had the charted periodic pulses of the mother on the fetal monitor strip to compare with the fetal tracing. So given the fact that the mother was presumptively infected because of the fever and the diagnosis of chorioamnionitis, she chose to continue with the external rather than risk infecting the baby in a situation where, from the scalp electrode, if she used an internal, from a situation where she was comfortable with the accuracy of the readings and the baby was not in any trouble.
But there was another method in addition to the scalpel method that could have been used.
To monitor the baby, it was external, which is what she was doing and is the most common method, or she could have chosen to use an internal electrode.
I have a concern, and that is I have a response that is not necessarily record-based. And then I have an obligation, of course, to have a record-based response. My response, not necessarily record-based, is this. Holy man. An 8-minute period during this 90-minute pushing, I'll call it the pushing stage. There must be something more reliable. That's what the Court of Appeals indicated. And it is reasonable to expect a health care provider to use the more reliable method. So that's one response, and it picks up off the Court of Appeals. The other response is there is a dispute, perhaps, in the record as to whether or not there was a failure of the external monitoring to cover the whole period of time. Where in the record can you point to that shows that the external monitoring during this 90-minute period adequately monitored the heartbeat of the baby?
Well, I think what I would say to that is during the pushing phase, where there's a lot of activity going on, it isn't unusual to have some periods of dropout, and that's common. The standard of care is not to put an internal lead in for all mothers that go through the pushing phase, especially when you have a situation where, as I said before, the mother is presumed to have be infected, the amniotic fluid is infected, and you make a judgment call as to which is...
So that's your argument.
Yes.
I want to know where in the record. I want to know, did Dr. Worthington say that? What doctor said that? Where in the record can I find what you're advancing?
I think the testimony of the defense experts, I can't cite to a specific page at this minute, dealt with the idea that there was an infection.
And was that a reason given at the time for not using the internal monitor, or was that an explanation post hoc for why one was not used?
I think her explanation, when questioned after the fact, was that this was information that she had available to her in making her decision-making, but prospectively she was concerned with the idea that it was adequately tracing, and the primary motivation for not using the internal was because she was satisfied with the quality of the tracing she was getting on the external.
In that 8-minute period,
yes,
in which the external monitor had cut out, is that a sufficient period of time to account for the injuries that were manifested by the child?
Well, one thing that the appellate court did not address, although they did talk about the plaintiff's experts, Dr. Bryan and Dr. Glass, was the testimony that came in from the defense experts and the significance of the pH of the baby at delivery, which showed a well-oxygenated baby given the pH, and that the infection had caused the baby's problem subclinically. It was not a baby that had been injured, in the opinion of the defense experts in various specialties, pathology, neurology, neonatal neurology, infectious disease. That testimony was that the baby had been injured by the subclinical infection that was not an injury that occurred from oxygen deprivation from an umbilical cord compression in the acute period before the delivery.
I take it that was a disputed question during trial?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. The pH level, that was taken from the umbilical cord, the blood?
Yes.
And The counter-argument to that appears to be that that has little significance because it didn't actually reflect the pH level of the baby's blood. It was simply the blood in the umbilical cord.
That was their contention. And Dr. Blackwell, I believe, felt that the pH was accurate and indicated an oxygenated baby, and he did not believe the tracing reflected that the baby was suffering from injuring umbilical cord compression during that last hour of the tracing.
And let me just see if I can understand that last part a little bit better. So the blood that was taken from the umbilical cord, that would have been the blood going to the baby?
Yes.
Okay. So what that's reflecting as an initial matter is that the blood on the way to the baby was well oxygenated. And the argument to the contrary is that it was pinched, yes, so that couldn't actually get to the baby?
Yes.
Okay. And I take it that's a disputed
yes.
fact as well?
Yes.
Okay. Can we talk just briefly about Miller? Is your contention that we should overrule Miller? Is that correct?
Well, overrule and clarify, because I don't believe that decision is applicable to the Barney case, because in the Miller case, what happened, I believe from reading the decision, was that the court felt that there was unanimity with respect to spinal tap being the only accurate way to evaluate whether a child had meningitis. In our case, there was not unanimity. There was a difference of opinion between experts on what had occurred here and whether there should have been a high index of suspicion that the baby was suffering from some type of significant compromise. So that's what I think the distinction the major distinctions were.
Right.
So that's not overruling. You're just asking us to find that Miller is not applicable here because there were alternative methods of diagnosis is what your argument is, at least based on the record.
Right. But I think that if Miller is meant to establish in the view of the appellate court that that we have a situation where only a definitive diagnosis should be made by the healthcare provider using a one specific tool, and that there's no room for options in a situation where there's disputed testimony as to whether there were options, then I think that has to...
Or distinguished,
okay. Yes. And there hasn't been a case, I think, in about 25 years where the Supreme Court has weighed in on this instruction, and I think that may be one reason why there was misapplication by the court in our case, because there wasn't a clear direction from the Supreme Court as to whether Finley would control, which is what the trial court judge felt in his decisions on motions after verdict, this case was more akin to, or whether, as the respondents believed, Miller versus Kim was more in line.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If it pleases the court, thank you. I'm Todd Weir. I represent the Injured Patients and Families Compensation Fund in this matter. This case, in my opinion, is before the court because, unfortunately, the Court of Appeals made factual findings when the evidence was in conflict. This error occurred because the Court of Appeals either ignored or overlooked important opinion evidence about the alternative methods to monitor a fetus in labor and whether those alternative methods, in fact, in this case, were working. With regard to the questions that have been posed, Justice Bradley, you asked if we could point to anything in the record that a scalp electrode would have altered what this external monitor was finding. And the answer to that is found by Dr. Blackwell at record 397. It's in my appendix, page 91. The question was posed to Dr. Blackwell, in your opinion, was the placement of a scalp electrode necessary in order to meet the standard of care? Answer, no. On to page 92 of my appendix, and this is the important issue that addresses exactly what your question was. If a scalp electrode had been placed, would it have changed the management at all of this labor? Answer, I don't believe so. That obviously includes the last 90 minutes. More importantly, because the issue here which has been transposed is, what are these monitors designed to diagnose? They are designed to diagnose, and it's in the ACOG bulletin that's attached in my appendix, they are designed to diagnose whether the fetus is being adequately oxygenated in utero. And if it is not being adequately oxygenated in utero, it can have what's called fetal distress. If it's not adequately oxygenated in utero, the pH at the time of birth will be low, because the fetus will start to try to live off its own tissue, if you will, and build up acid. But here's the important question to Dr. Blackwell.
Again,
the morphing here has...
Make sure to cite.
Sure. The morphing here is to suggest that these fetal monitor tracing devices should, on a minute-by-minute basis, be able to tell definitively whether it's maternal or fetal. And that's absolutely not the case. I'll get back to that. That's with Dr. Bryan. The question here, it's record 397. It's page 92 of the fund's appendix. Was there any reasonable possibility, in your opinion, that for substantial periods of time, the real fetal tracing was being missed and the maternal was being traced and you were missing the status of this fetus during this labor? Answer, other than the period of the epidural, I'd say no. This baby was born at 9:27 p.m. The epidural, which will cause a position change in mother, and hence this external monitor will lose the tone for periods of time, which, by the way, is common. He says, other than the period of epidural, I'd say no. The epidural was 8:08 in the morning, more than 12 hours before. So the opinion of Dr. Blackwell was that this monitor, this external monitor, this recognized alternative method to monitor this baby in utero was working.
Okay, so that's your argument, and there's going to be an argument from the other side, and I don't want to get into which of those is correct here. The question we have to figure out is whether this jury instruction should have been given.
Right.
So tell me, and that seems to come down to the question of at what point is the external monitoring device an illegible mechanism under these circumstances to monitor the baby's condition?
In the opinion of the defense experts, as I just read from Dr. Blackwell, never.
But that can't be the answer. If it simply stops monitoring the heartbeat, and let's say the labor goes for an hour, and for an hour it's just not monitoring the heartbeat, well, clearly that's crossed some line where that external monitor is no longer doing its job, right?
That's correct. That's not our case, but that's correct.
No. So what your case is trying to figure out at what point is it no longer legitimate for a medical practitioner to rely on the external monitor for determining whether the baby is in distress, right? So how do we figure out that line? What are the considerations that go into figuring out at this point the external monitor is no longer a valid method of diagnosing the baby's condition?
That's based entirely on the expert testimony, and here there was conflicting expert testimony because the defense experts...
Well, I know, but they're making conclusory statements which are entirely unhelpful to developing a rule. What is the standard? At what point? Is it 5 minutes? Is it 10 minutes? Is there some other factor that goes into saying that external monitor is no longer useful for the purpose of...
It would be when all the experts concede that under that set of circumstances, be it 5 minutes, be it 20 minutes, be it an hour, that external monitor, which started as a recognized alternative method of treatment and diagnosis, is no longer a reasonable exercise, a reasonable alternative method.
Right. So when
when we get
into the question of reasonableness, we're looking for standards, right? So you say in 8 minutes period where it's not monitoring the baby, that's acceptable. That the external monitor is still an acceptable method of determining the status of the baby. Is that true at 10 minutes?
Dr. Blackwell addressed that very issue. It's the record page, or it's record 397. It's petitioner, the funds appendix at page 85. And the question was posed to him, if you have a couple of minute drop off, what's the relevance of that? And he says, and you've touched on one of my major pet peeves. When we try to interpret the fetal heart rate, I try to describe this to our students and nurses, that if you're a film critic and you're going to sit down and watch a two-hour movie, you can't watch 45 seconds of it and say whether it's a good film. A 10-minute version of the tracing is really the epic that we use to decide. Because Dr. Bryan, right in the beginning of this case, the very first expert that testified was Dr. Bryan. And he was asked, and this is record 381, it's the funds appendix, page 43. The question was, I believe that sometimes the heartbeat is monitored by electronic fetal monitoring. His answer, affirming there are alternative methods. There's different ways to monitor the fetal heart rate. In this particular case, this was an induction, meaning that they're trying to bring about the labor because she has not gone into labor on her own spontaneously. So electronic monitoring is always used as opposed to listening to a stethoscope. In some cases, the fetal heart rate is done by stethoscope. So the real question I think you're asking is, once it's been established that a method is a recognized alternative method, does the defendant lose the instruction just because a plaintiff's expert says that was no longer reasonable under the circumstances? And I think the answer to that is no, and has to be no, and that's why this case is far different than Miller versus Kim.
Why is it no?
Why is it no? Because the jury is the one that decides based upon the conflicting evidence. In medicine, we're not going to have finite rules. Practicing medicine is an art as well as a science. To get back to your question, Justice Kennedy, about the pH, and this is record page 397. It's the funds appendix, page 89. Dr. Blackwell again. And with respect to this case, doctor, we've heard testimony, and you know from the record, the pH of London's umbilical artery taken by Dr. Mickelson at the time of birth was 7.23. Yes. Question. And do you believe that was a valid, accurate measurement? Answer, yes. Importantly, he then ties that reading, which demonstrates the fetus was well oxygenated all the way up to birth. Question, is it consistent with the fetal monitor strip tracing that you saw? Answer, yes. And to further expand on this point, the law is clear that where there is a conflict in the evidence and inconsistent theories on the cause of the event are advanced, we believe instructions encompassing both theories should be given. And that's basically bedrock law, that the court needs to instruct on an issue which is raised by the evidence. It needs to, or it's error. Dr. Worthington, record 394, the funds appendix at page 78. One final question. Was utilizing an external monitor a recognized alternative method to monitor this fetus? Answer, yes. And in administering and applying that method of external monitor, did Dr. Mickelson use reasonable care, skill, and judgment in administering that method? Answer, yes. When you go to the jury instruction, this optional paragraph, it tracks directly. It would have been error for the trial court not to have instructed on the alternative method once that testimony is in. That testimony, Justice Bradley, encompasses the last 90 minutes here.
See, that's my problem. It isn't totally clear to me whether it does encompass the last 90 minutes. And your opposing counsel raises the argument that these general comments of, yes, it's an accepted alternative, don't really focus on that pushing stage.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. I would submit, Justice Bradley, mm-hmm. that is precisely why our evidence code has 90407, that an expert can address the ultimate issue to be decided by the jury. The ultimate issue here is whether this was a recognized alternative. I don't believe it's the defense job, just because a plaintiff's expert disagrees with what this external monitor tracing is showing, to parse it out to 90 minutes, 60 minutes, 70 minutes, 5 minutes. That's why cross-examination exists, I would humbly suggest. So we even look at Dr. Bryan, and the point is these external monitors have discontinuity. It's just known by the science. It's absolutely known. Sure. Is an internal monitor going to get you? My time is up, I see. I'm sorry. Thank you for your time and patience.
It's hard when you split it like that. And when you two do rebuttal, you're going to take a deep breath and be done. So I urge you, it's difficult. You thought it was hard this time. It gets tougher when you get to rebuttal.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Thank you for indulging us in this. My name is Jeffrey Goldberg. I have the privilege of representing the plaintiffs, London Barney, and his mother, Raquel, through the guardian, David Lowe. The arguments that we've heard, just like the briefs that we've seen, are not focusing on the issues that I think are before the court, as some of the questions from Your Honor, Justice Bradley, point out. The open-ended questions that they gave to their expert talked about substantial periods of time. Was it substantial? The labor went on over 24 hours. We're not contesting that an external monitor was an inappropriate tool to use at moment one when she came in and was being induced. What we're talking about is the last 90 minutes of the case. What happens when the mother starts pushing, when her heart rate goes up as she pushes, just like anyone that exercises, it can get confused with the fetuses, and you'll start seeing the heart rate go up when the mother pushes, a pattern that a fetus would never show. This is the last 90 minutes when she was pushing. The best evidence that this was problematic at that point comes from Dr. Mickelson herself. She said three things. One, in order to monitor the fetus during labor, you must know the baby's heart rate. There is no other way to monitor the fetus. We don't have another tool during labor. Number two, she said herself, I know that when the heart rate goes up with maternal pushing, that is a classic sign that the monitor is having a problem. It is picking up the mother's heart rate, not the baby. Number three, she said, I could not tell definitely or definitively whether I was looking at the mother or the baby. Once she can't say to a reasonable degree of certainty, and she couldn't, she said, I can't tell for sure. We had an hour and a half when we weren't accurately monitoring the baby, not 8 minutes. There was 8 minutes where we get some sketchiness and some dropout. That's not going to cause the brain damage that London suffered. All the experts concur on that. 8 minutes is not going to do it. So what we have is the exact situation in Miller. We have an index of suspicion. Once the index of suspicion arises, there are a couple of methods. There would have been two alternatives, none of which were used in this case. The alternatives for Dr. Mickelson would have been to do one of principally two things. One, put on a fetal scalp electrode. It is perfectly appropriate. It's done all the time when women have a fever. There is a chance of a skin infection. Number two, you track the mother's pulse right on the fetal monitor. They print them out as two lines, and if the two lines are separate and apart, you know one is the mother, one is the baby. But if they're coextensive and they overlap with each other, you know, no, wait a minute, I'm seeing what I thought was the baby, it's really the mother. There are your two alternatives. Those are the alternative methods, and neither of them were done in this case.
Okay, so your case, if I'm understanding it correctly, depends on a conclusion that continued use of the external monitor was no longer appropriate.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and that's what your experts said.
And it's what Dr. Worthington said in his deposition. This was very interesting. We pointed it out, and it's in the record.
That's going to get into credibility and all that. That's for the jury to do. All right. So your position is continued use of the external monitor is no longer acceptable because of these periods of dropping out, and that indicated you've got to use a different method. But there were experts on the other side of that say continued use of the external monitor was acceptable, correct?
No, Your Honor, and I just want to be completely accurate. The external monitor would be used throughout this period of time. The difference is...
with the external as opposed to additionally using the internal.
Exactly.
Right. So there were experts who said that continued use of just the external monitor, as it was done, was an acceptable way of monitoring the baby's condition.
No, they did not say that would distinguish and clearly tell you what was the baby's heart rate. That was the point.
Hang on a second. There was expert testimony that said that continued use of the external monitor alone was acceptable under these circumstances. Yes?
Never specifically addressed to just the last hour and a half when the pushing. The open-ended question that you saw in the record was during the labor, was it reasonable to use that? Yes, there was. He said during labor. But when we cross-examined, it was clear that would not differentiate between the two. Also, Dr. Worthington, their expert, said the fetal monitoring that I was seeing, that I saw, showed what was developing as an acidotic baby, a baby that was becoming acidotic. He testified to that in his deposition, and it was shown to the jury. So he knew the monitoring that was being shown was showing an acidotic baby.
But the pH is an acidotic. 7.2 is not an acidotic baby.
No, and the point is he knew the baby was acidotic. What happens is when the umbilical cord is crimped and pinched off, when they deliver the baby is over on the other side of the pinching, the baby can become severely acidotic. When they draw the blood, if the blood is drawn from where the pinch is between there and the placenta, you're not going to get a true reflection of the baby. And every expert acknowledges that is a well-known factor in medicine, a well-known occurrence, that you will get a total disparity between the two. And
what evidence is there to show this baby was acidotic? Is there any other pH reading that was taken of the child itself?
Yes. When was
that done?
The pH was done within minutes. Within the first hour of birth, it was shown severe acidosis.
What was it?
I don't, Your Honor, have that
2.1,
memorized.
2.1, 2.3, you don't know? Is it in the record?
Well, the point is the base deficit was extremely high. The pH will normalize within a matter of minutes after birth, but the base deficit was still grossly beyond minus 19.
My questions were in response to your saying this was an acidotic baby. And I'm asking you, where's the test that shows an acidotic level?
The blood gas after birth shows a significant base deficit. You don't measure the pH because that will...
Where in the record do you think this evidence is?
I'd be happy to submit it afterwards, Your Honor. I have not...
You don't know where?
I know it's in the record at many points in the testimony of Dr. Stephen Glass and of all the maternal fetal medicines, Dr. Worthington, Dr.
Blackwell.
So you're
saying there was a base deficit. That's your term.
Yes.
What's in the base deficit? Why do you pick that term?
Your Honor, because when measuring the degree of acidosis in a fetus, you're looking at two things. One is the pH, and one is the base deficit. The two numbers go together.
But what's in the base deficit? What is it you're measuring? pH is measuring acidity.
Right.
What's the base deficit measuring?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Base deficit measures when a body becomes acidotic, the body uses buffers to throw it on the acid, buffer base. Base deficit is how deficient the baby is in base, how much base they've used up to counteract the acidosis.
Okay. All right. I understand what you're saying now. Thank you. Thank you.
Counsel, usually in these jury instructions case, we talk about it being in a view for an erroneous exercise of discretion. Obviously, it needs to fairly describe the law, too, so there's a sort of a component of kind of an independent review in there as well. But I think when we talk about that, we're talking about that because the trial court is there and is there to read the evidence in a way that the appellate court's not, right? I understand your view that you didn't think the evidence showed that there could have been that Dr. Mickelson acted within the standard of care by continuing to use the monitor she was and not add the other pieces as you've suggested. But isn't there a sense here where our review is whether the trial court thought that was inappropriate or the evidence was readable that way and therefore has some discretion in giving that instruction to the jury?
Two reasons, no, Your Honor. Number one, this was not a question of two methods of treatment. It was diagnosis, and yet the instruction he gave dealt with treatment, which was clearly confusing to the jury. This is diagnosis is what we're using the fetal monitoring for. Number two, if you look at the record, and it's cited in the defendant's brief, the record by the trial judge, he clearly said one of the options is you're saying it was lack of oxygen and fetal monitoring. The other is their theory is that it was infection causing this. And there are two alternative theories on what was going on. And I believe the trial judge was not understanding the issue, and that's why this is important. Under the Miller case, we don't believe the alternative methods is really appropriate when you're talking about a diagnosis case. What we're talking about here is every one of the experts acknowledged that with the rises in the heart rate, not the 8 minutes, which is insignificant, the 90 minutes, when you have rises in heart rate and you have an index of suspicion and you know the only tool you have to evaluate the baby is what that heart rate is, then the reasonable standard of care requires you to do something reasonable to do it. There were two alternative methods available, neither one of which was used. Neither one of which was used to differentiate. So once you have the external monitor causing the question to be raised, and there now are alternative methods to clear that up, then under Miller, doing nothing is not an alternative method, and that's what was being done. There was nothing being done different that hadn't raised this question in the first place.
And you dispute then what the defense is saying, which is that the alternative method was the external monitoring, and that's what they're saying their experts said. You're
right.
Saying that's not an alternative method.
Because the trial testimony is that the external monitor alone, without continuous pulse oximetry, will not differentiate between whether you've got the mother or the baby. It just is not capable of doing it.
Is there testimony, though, that I thought I saw in the record that the internal doesn't necessarily distinguish it either?
No, not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I apologize if I forgot. I believe the internal monitor, an internal monitor can rarely, there is a time it will, but not generally with a live fetus. An internal monitor, if properly placed, will not pick up the mother's heart rate.
I mean, it's obviously not for us to be, you know, the testimony is a testimony. It's in the record, and we're bound by that. So you're saying that I didn't read that I was mistaken on that?
I don't deny I can be mistaken, but I don't believe that an internal monitor, a fetal scalp electrode, when it's placed in the baby's head, will ever pick up the mother's heart rate if the baby is alive.
Counsel, I looked for disputed testimony during this, what I'll call, 90-minute period of time, because it is my belief If it's disputed, it's for the jury to decide. You might want to correct me, but that's my thought processes. And so I looked at Dr. Blackwell's testimony, and he was asked about this period of time when they were watching. There was a question of whether they were watching mom or the baby, and I take that to be the 90-minute period, because there didn't seem to be any question prior to that as to and the hours of labor.
Correct.
Who are you watching?
Correct.
So I'm reading, I don't know, I have the excerpt, and it's page 59 of someone's appendix. And the question of Dr. Blackwell is this, and we get to the punchline in a couple of questions. On page 59, the answer as to how many ways there are, he says, that's one way. There are other ways. This is one way. Question, and the other way is to put on a pulse oximeter. Answer, that's another way. And another way is to watch the continuous fetal heart rate tracing. Question, no doctor. Watching it continuously may not tell you whether you're really watching mom or watching the baby, correct? Now, this is the punchline. He responds, I believe that it did, I believe it can, and I believe it's within the standard of care. I interpret that as testimony from Dr. Blackwell saying during the 90-minute period of time that that this external monitoring can tell whether you're really watching mom or watching the baby, and that it was within the standard of care.
Your Honor, I believe the answer to that question comes from Dr. Mickelson herself. She was at the bedside. She wasn't a hired expert that came in to say something. She was at the bedside. She said, and I was standing there, and I couldn't tell. And if she says that she can't tell, and the only way she can evaluate the fetus is by fetal monitoring, and there are reasonable steps, then in a differential diagnosis, as in the Miller case, doing nothing is not an alternative method where she herself says, I couldn't tell by that method.
Why shouldn't I take this approach? That as long as there is testimony in the record, and I read it, so you may interpret it differently than I do. But there's testimony in the record, and who knows what the jury saw or relied on. Dr. Mickelson's testimony may be to the contrary. But it isn't for us to weigh the testimony. It's to see if there is sufficient evidence in the record to sustain the jury's determination.
I understand that, Your Honor. But if the defendant is the one who's at the bedside and we're trying to determine the issue is whether she used reasonable care, and that's a question for the jury. And if that witness is saying, I was not capable with that device of determining which is mother than which is baby, then in her hands and for her uses, it was not a reasonable alternative method. She was not capable of doing it. Dr. Blackwell may know a whole bunch of things that she doesn't know, but we're talking about the standard of care of the doctor at the bedside. And if the doctor at the bedside, using her judgment, could not determine and yet had available to her two tools.
What is the standard? I draw this from the back of my head. Any credible evidence? And so this is any evidence. I grant you that the testimony of Dr. Mickelson is, if I were weighing it, would certainly have a lot of weight because she was there, and perhaps it was not in her best interest to say what she said. But any credible evidence. So you're asking us, as a matter of law, to find Dr. Blackwell's testimony not credible?
No, Your Honor. I'm asking, as a matter of law, when the doctor who is caring for the patient says, I was not able, we're testing whether she was reasonable and used methods, where she is saying, I was not capable of doing it. Dr. Blackwell can say other people may have been able to and should have been able to. But where the doctor, who is the defendant in the case and about whom we're using the jury instruction, says, I was not capable of determining, I needed one of two alternative methods, either a fetal scalp electrode or this pulse oximetry, one of those would have done it, and she said that would have helped me figure it out. Where she says that and she doesn't use one of the two alternative methods, then we have exactly the Miller case where the index of suspicion was raised, the doctor admitted she had an index of suspicion, and the doctor admitted that she had tools available and chose not to use any of the alternatives.
Was there any motion to strike the testimony of Dr. Blackwell?
To strike it? No.
Yeah.
No,
okay.
I mean...
So his testimony went to the jury along with the testimony of the treating physician and the experts that... her insurance carrier provided to the jury trial, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So the jury heard from at least three different doctors on what should have occurred here, correct?
Yeah, actually four, but yes.
Okay. All right.
Could you point I'm sorry, were you finished?
Yeah, I'm done. Thanks, Dan.
Could you point me to Dr. Mickelson's testimony that you've been referring to, stating that she could not distinguish between the mother's heartbeat and the baby's heartbeat?
It's in our brief. I don't have the direct cite. She says, I could not definitively and we did put that in our brief.
I kind of want to put that in some context. That's a nice little snippet. But I wonder, is she talking about the entirety of the labor? Talking about a specific point in time?
Your Honor, those questions dealt solely with the line of questioning that when she saw the rise in the heart rate,
yes,
when the mother was pushing,
right,
that is a classic sign of fetus. And then I asked her, well, can you tell which it was? And she said, no, I could not.
At that point.
She could not tell at that point.
And what about during the periods of time between the pushing? Did she say she couldn't tell then either?
The period of time between the pushing, you don't know, because the classic sign is going to be the what happens during the push. That'll be the differentiation. When you see just a regular heartbeat, it's very difficult to isolate whether that's mother or baby because there's no distinguishing factors about it during those periods of stress. The distinguishing factor is how the heart rate pattern fluctuates during a push. A baby will normally decelerate during the push, mom accelerates. Other than that, just looking at the tracing, it would be virtually impossible for a relatively short window, even 20 minutes or so, to tell what is mother, what is baby.
So is it your position that if I were to go back and reread through the testimony on this point, that during the entirety of the labor Dr. Mickelson had testified that she could not distinguish between the baby's heartbeat and the mother's heartbeat?
No, just during the time of pushing, Your Honor. When she was pushing, the pushing only occurred in approximately the last 90 minutes. I think it was 87 minutes, roughly. But
so your position is for that 90-minute time frame, your position is that all of the testimony in the record demonstrates that no one could distinguish between the baby's heartbeat and the mother's heartbeat.
The testimony is clear that Dr. Mickelson said she couldn't. Dr. Worthington, in his deposition, said he couldn't. He thought it was a largely mother. Then at trial, changed and said, no, he thought it was fetus. And Dr. Blackwell said he thought he could tell, and it wasn't, in his opinion, consistent with a non-acidotic or with an acidotic fetus.
Okay. But as far as you're concerned, Dr. Mickelson's testimony was clear that she, during that 90-minute time period, her testimony is she could not distinguish between the mother's heartbeat and the baby's heartbeat.
During the periods of pushing, yes.
Okay.
Not in between pushings.
Okay. Well, see, that seems to be a significant distinction that you're making there, doesn't it?
No.
If it's possible for her to distinguish between the mother's heartbeat and the baby's heartbeat when she's not pushing.
No. What happens is it's very difficult for anyone to tell if a line at a certain number at 140 beats per minute is mother or baby. The way you determine whether that is mother or baby is to look at what happens to that rate during a period of maternal pushing. If that rate were to go up, you know you've got mother, and
right.
It can jump between.
Yeah, so here's what I'm having difficulty with then. If that's the sole determinant on whether you are distinguishing between the mother's heartbeat and the baby's heartbeat, then your conclusion should be Dr. Mickelson testified that during that 90-minute time period, she could not distinguish between the baby's heartbeat and the
mother. And she said she could not definitively say which is mother and which is baby.
All right, and that's what you believe the testimony shows?
Absolutely.
Counsel, I note that in paragraph 6 of the Court of Appeals opinion, it states, Dr. Mickelson admitted that there were time periods, particularly in the last portion of Raquel's labor, where Dr. Mickelson could not obtain a good fetal tracing and could not definitively determine whether certain portions of the strips were monitoring the fetal or the maternal heart rate. At the end of that paragraph, the Court of Appeals states, Dr. Mickelson admitted that a pulse exometer, a non-invasive method of continually monitoring the maternal heart rate, could have been used on Raquel to eliminate any confusion between maternal and fetal heart rate tracings, but she did not employ that method. It appears to me that the Court of Appeals relied on those admissions quite heavily in their opinion, essentially saying, look, there was another more reliable method that should have been used, and Dr. Mickelson acknowledged or admitted that.
Yes, Your Honor, that's what I was trying to point out, that she acknowledged that she herself, who was at the bedside caring for the patient, knew she couldn't tell what is a mother's and what is a baby, knew it's very important, vital for the baby's well-being, and knew that there were multiple alternative options, none of which that she chose to use. So, yes, the appellate court, I believe, clearly did rely on that admission from her. That's the index of suspicion under the Miller case, and that's when two options became available, neither of which did she choose to use, which is why we think the alternative methods instruction should not have been given. It's not what was done early on in the case. It's what was done during the period of time that is most stressful for the fetus, as it acknowledged by every expert in the case, the pushing phase, when she herself said, I couldn't tell.
Counsel, I think it's important that we be very careful about representing what the doctor's testimony was. I just pulled it up in the appendix, and during the trial, Dr. Mickelson was asked, so you agree it could be the mother's heart rate? And her answer was, but I thought it was the fetal heart rate. As I read her testimony, she was saying at the time when she had to make that judgment call, if you will, she thought that the mother's or the fetal heart rate was being traced. When she was pushed, not surprisingly, on cross-examination, she did acknowledge that as she sits here today, meaning in the context of a trial and with the benefit of looking at it retrospectively, she said, I can't definitively say that's the baby. But I understand her testimony to be that at the time the fetal tracing was actually occurring, she thought it was the baby.
And that's the question about whether she was negligent or not. That's what the reasonable standard implies, because she acknowledged that she couldn't definitively tell that. She couldn't say, and she knew that there were alternative methods available, none of which did she choose to utilize.
You have the testimony of Dr. Blackwell, which seems to be crystal clear. He was asked, was there any reasonable possibility, in your opinion, that for substantial periods of time, which I think one would characterize the 90-minute period of pushing that you've been talking about, the real fetal tracing was being missed and maternal was being traced, and you were missing the status of this fetus during this labor. And the answer of Dr. Blackwell was, other than the time period of the epidural, I'd say no. So going back to Dr. Mickelson's testimony, I don't read that as a concession, and you have expert testimony kind of backing that up.
I believe taking Dr. Mickelson's testimony in totality, what she said was she couldn't clearly say that, and Dr. Worthington also said the same thing in his deposition, that it was not clear whether, could not be established whether it was mother or baby, and a child's life is at stake.
See, now, counsel, that's why I was pushing you so hard on what the record shows in this case, because that makes a substantial difference in our decision on whether the instruction was appropriate, right? I mean, if there were, if she conceded the point and there is no expert testimony indicating that this is a potentially legitimate way of monitoring the baby's condition, then perhaps the instruction was not warranted because there is no testimony to warrant it, right? But if there is some testimony, mustn't the court give the instruction?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Where it is unclear and there were alternative methods, none of which were being used, the external monitor alone does not differentiate.
I know, but that requires that we accept the word of your experts over the other experts, doesn't it?
No, it requires, because Dr. Mickelson says she couldn't definitively tell, even in hindsight can't definitively tell.
Wait now. Hang on. See, now that's, again, I want to make sure that we're clear with the testimony. In hindsight, she says she couldn't tell definitively. She says at the moment she believed that she was monitoring the baby's heartbeat.
Right, and that's why she was negligent at that time. And okay. That's why...
That might be the case, and that's why the last sentence of the instruction exists, right? The last sentence of the instruction says, Dr. Mickelson was not negligent because she chose to use one of those recognized treatment methods rather than another recognized treatment method if she used reasonable care, skill, and judgment in administering that method.
And that's the problem. She put it on correctly. She administered it and put on the devices. No one is questioning the nurses put it on. It's administering. That's why it's confusing.
There's a whole lot more that goes into using an external monitor than just putting it on correctly, right?
Yes.
It requires judgment in monitoring it.
Yes.
Okay. So that goes into using judgment in administering the method that she had chosen, which was the external monitor. So what I'm concerned about is if what you're asking us to do is to say that this jury instruction was inappropriate, that requires that we find that there is no evidence in the record that would suggest that this was a legitimate way of monitoring the baby's condition during the labor, right?
Correct.
Okay. And what Justice Rebecca Bradley just read and what the other experts said was that at the time they believed this was appropriate. Now, how can a court deny the jury instruction when there is evidence introduced that suggests that that the treating doctor believed that she was monitoring the baby's condition? And the expert says, that's the way you do it, and this is an acceptable way of doing it.
Have my red light? May I
you
respond?
Can answer, yes, you can answer his question.
Your Honor, because in this situation, she wasn't doing anything to differentiate between the two and knew that there was a problem and a risk. So there were alternative methods available to her that were not used to differentiate. We did not question using an external monitor for induction for 20 hours. But during the pushing phase is the only time we're talking about doing something to differentiate, as in Miller, the court ruled, and the appellate court decided, that when there's an index of suspicion raised, you have the duty to do something in a diagnosis case, which is what this was.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors.
So you have 2.5 minutes.
2.5, right.
Okay.
I'll bring it in two.
There you go.
Thank you. Very briefly, I think I'd like to put to rest the business about what Dr. Mickelson testified to, because I think what was discussed by counsel was not accurate completely with respect to her testimony. And I refer you to the petitioner's appendix, page 47, where... Dr. Mickelson said, I was looking at the tracing overall from the whole day, and I could rule out that the entire tracing was the maternal. I was confident that the majority of the tracing, except for a few small spots, was the baby. And I showed the mother how the baby's heart rate was generally at a certain level, where her heart rate was, and where there were portions of the strip where the heart rates were clearly different. And so I believe prospectively as well as retrospectively, Dr. Mickelson was communicating that when you look at the entire strip, she's confident except for a few small sections that she admitted to the trial, she wasn't sure she could distinguish were fetal. And she was using, she maybe didn't use pulse oximeter or internal, but she used the charted information on the strip when the periodic pulses of the mother were taken. She could hear the tone of the heart tones, and she had the fetal monitor tracing. And so I would just conclude by saying that we know that, as articulated by the court, it's up to the jury to decide issues of fact. They're supposed to hear the basic facts, fairly evaluate it, and then reach the ultimate conclusion as the prior fact. I think the appellate court usurped the function of the jury. There was a lot of credible evidence on the issue of alternative methods of treatment, as well as how oxygenated the baby was and whether the baby was even injured from this or for the infection. And I think that the jury verdict should stand because they were the triers of fact and should have been allowed to render the decision that they did. Thank you.
Well, you are good to your word.
Thank you again, and I think I owe you some time, so I will try to be very brief. I just want to address the questions that have been raised, specifically the 90-minute period. Dr. Blackwell, and this is record 398, it's the PUNS appendix 101 and 102. The question posed to him, Dr. Ross talked about artifact and the fact that the maternal pulse can be picked up as artifact. Is there a difference between picking up a maternal pulse as artifact as compared to a complete switch to maternal pulse? That's what the plaintiffs are claiming happened here. The fetus wasn't being monitored because you missed that last 90 minutes. Dr. Blackwell, I think there's a significant difference. I mean, I think that it is a known phenomena that a monitor can misinterpret a fetal heart and a maternal heart sometimes. I have certainly seen it, and I believe that it happens. It's something in those cases you need to worry about. I don't believe it happened here. As I continuously watch the tracing, and as we saw, we've seen hours and hours of tracings. The baby's heart rate, like our heart rate, changes. The last 90 minutes, that's when mom is pushing. At Appendix 102, same record, 398. Prospectively here, at any time, including those last panels that you've been shown, where there are some accelerations during the contractions, was it necessary for the healthcare team to meet the standard of care, and specifically Dr. Mickelson, to believe she might have been confronted with a switch from fetal to maternal pulse? Well, the baby is near being delivered, obviously the last 90 minutes. And she's in the second stage, which by definition is when she's pushing. She's pushing. The baby is going to come out pretty soon. And that wouldn't be my interpretation. My interpretation is the bulk of the continuous tracing is fetal. I think it's consistent with the umbilical pH as well, which was normal. He again brings it full circle. This recognized alternative method of an external monitor, in fact, worked during this labor and delivery. Finally, with regard to Dr. Mickelson, this is record 380. It's the funds appendix at page 41. Here we're right at the end. Doctor, although you have seen certain panels prior to 2100, was there anything about those panels that made you think that you needed to change the indications for continuing with a vaginal labor or vaginal delivery? No, because I would look at the whole part and I could see that the time in the last 15 minutes was perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's a tough case. It's always hard when a baby is born and things go wrong. I thank you both for really good briefs and it's going to be a difficult case for the court as well. We are going to adjourn now, and the court will meet in closed conference at 5:03.
Julie?